The Residential Segregation of Baltimore's Jews, Restrictive Covenants or Gentleman's Agreement, by Garrett Power. Introduction. The migration of Jews to Baltimore's northwest suburbs is an oft-told tale. Between 1860 and 1960, as its population grew from 7,000 to 78,000, the Jewish community moved from the densely packed row houses of Old Town in East Baltimore to the leafy suburbs on the northwest side of town. Baltimore's Jews recongregated on the northwest bank of the Jones Falls in a contiguous cluster of suburbs reaching Upper Park Heights Avenue. In 100 years, the Jewish community had grown tenfold and moved its center 10 miles from its point of origin. Most Jews continued to live apart from Gentiles, even after half a century of assimilation into the mainstream of the city's professional, business, and academic life. Among them was the Jewish elite, most of whose members refrained from crossing over and joining the Gentile lawyers, doctors, merchants, and manufacturers in the bourgeois utopias to the northeast of the Jones Falls Valley. A new Northwest Jewish colony had replaced the old East Baltimore ghetto. This essay examines why Jews of all classes remained together, even in the suburbs. Segregation. Generally, this segregation is attributed to deed covenants which prohibited Jewish occupancy in Gentile suburbs. For example, Leon Sachs, longtime director of the Baltimore Jewish Council, explained as follows. The Roland Park Company began to develop Guilford and Homeland, and somebody got the bright idea that if you make something exclusive, it's more expensive, so they put restrictions in their deeds. No Jews, blacks, or Orientals. According to Sachs, the idea of covenants soon caught on, leaving Jews but a single slice of the suburban pie. The Park Heights section, Northwest Baltimore, Forest Park. Journalist Stephen Sagner agreed, recounting his grandfather's tale. For most of this century, restrictive covenants ensured that genteel Roland Park and Guilford would remain upper class, WASP, and Catholic. Jews stayed on the west side of what is now the Jones Falls Expressway, every generation moving further northwest to bigger houses and away from blacks. There is some truth in this explanation, but a review of the documentary record suggests that it is hardly the whole story. Suburbs. There is nothing novel in a story of middle-class migration to the edges of the post-industrial city. Robert Fishman and others have described the forces that made suburbs attractive during the first half of the 20th century. Crime and pollution pushed, and the dream of a pastoral family life pulled the outwardly mobile beyond the old city. Turn of the century Baltimore was no exception. On the preferred high ground to the north, land speculation companies were selling building lots to the captains of industry, merchant chiefs, and professional elites. They promised the development of suburbs restricted to grand cottages and garden villas. On the northwest side of the Jones Falls, Walbrook, Forest Park, and Ashburton competed with Roland Park on the northeast side for preeminence. The Roland Park Company had a virtual monopoly on the prime northern suburbs to the east of the Jones Falls. By 1924, it claimed 1,500 acres of restricted land. It sold building lots in a series of plats: Roland Park, 1893 to 1915, Guilford, 1913, Homeland, 1924, and Northwood, 1931. Restrictions. Well-to-do middle-class Protestants and Catholics were moving in droves to these restricted suburbs. The restrictions were found in deed covenants, in which buyers and sellers mutually agreed to limit the uses of the building lots. The covenants ran with the land, so as to be binding on subsequent purchasers. Once in place, they promised all members of the community a first-class neighborhood. Developers used the deed restrictions as a marketing device. For example, advertisements urged newcomers to live in the Roland Park Guilford District, 1,000 acres of restricted land where artfully designed protective covenants safeguard owners from encroachment of business and from other uses of property detrimental to the value and general good of a residential section. Discrimination. There was rampant discrimination in Baltimore's 20th century real estate market. After the city's effort to exclude Negroes from white neighborhoods through the use of segregation ordinances was held unconstitutional, an informal plan for racial segregation was put into effect. City agencies worked together with real estate professionals and white community associations to discourage Black invasion of white space. The Roland Park Company considered the use of deed restrictions to exclude Negroes as early as 1893, but at first decided against it. In 1910, however, it became locked into a competition with the Northwest suburb Forest Park to see which could be the most exclusive in town. Thereafter, the company placed a clause excluding Negro occupancy in the deeds for its subdivisions. These restrictions remained in effect until 1948, when the U.S. Supreme Court declared the enforcement of racial restrictions unconstitutional as a denial of equal protection. Anti-Semitism was also widespread. Old newspapers are filled with advertisements for apartments for rent to Gentiles only. Ashburton's developer, George Morris, bragged before the Baltimore City Council in 1953 that the exclusion of Jews was good business. The Roland Park Company, when selling its lots, screened out Jews to make sure that all buyers would be congenial neighbors. Covenants. A thoughtful search of the public land records, however, has failed to disclose a single instance in which the Roland Park Company used deed covenants to exclude Jews. This research found deed covenants which excluded Jews only for the northwest suburbs of West Forest Park, 1927, and George Morris's Ashburton, 1927. The deeds for those subdivisions conditioned sales on the developer's written approval of the purchaser's character, desirability, and other qualifications, and were intended to exclude Negroes, Jews, and other unwanted minorities. They proved very short-lived, however, as in 1929, the Maryland Court of Appeals declared the clause void, as against the public policy favoring free transfer of land. One cannot say with complete certainty that the Roland Park Company never used deed restrictions to keep Jews out. In the course of subdividing the plats for Roland Park, Guilford, Homeland, and Northwood, the company granted approximately 3,000 deeds. A massive title search would be required to establish that none of these deeds contained covenants excluding Jews. Based on the absence of such restrictions from the sampling of deeds read as part of this research, however, it is possible to conclude that formal deed restrictions were not the effective cause of the exclusion of Jews from Roland Park suburbs. Gentlemen's Agreement. This then poses two intriguing questions. Why was the Jewish residential population heavily concentrated in the northwest suburbs? And why is there a popular belief that deed covenants excluded Jews from the Roland Park Company suburbs when none can be found to exist in the land records? Perhaps the answer lies in the nature of what was sometimes called the gentleman's agreement. The Roland Park Company instituted policies, informal and unwritten, but clearly understood, whereby only the right sort of people would be welcome in the community, and Jews were understood to be the wrong sort. The company refused to sell its lots to Negroes, Jews, and other unwanted minorities. When secondhand houses came up for sale, real estate brokers joined in. They deemed it unethical to sell a house to someone of the Jewish race in a Christian neighborhood. This gentleman's agreement proved very effective. A 1928 survey by the Baltimore Council of Churches found that only 13 of over 2,525 families surveyed in companies' subdivisions of Roland Park, Guilford, Homeland, and Northwood were Jewish. But there was another agreement at work. Jews, as a minority subculture in America, faced hard choices as to how to relate to and interact with the majority. Some favored full participation in the mainstream of American life, while others felt that the community should voluntarily make choices which preserve Jewish culture and tradition. The residential concentration of Baltimore's Jews is, in some measure, the result of a free choice by observant Jews to live close to one another and apart from Gentiles. Hence, the residential segregation of Baltimore's Jews on the northwest side of town is best understood as the result of two kinds of separate understandings with a common result, but sought by different parties for different motives. Anti-Semitic Gentiles agreed among themselves to exclude Jews from their neighborhoods. When doing so, they violated the civil right to freedom of choice in the place of residence. Observant Jews agreed among themselves to live together in cohesive neighborhoods. When doing so, they were motivated by a desire to preserve their culture and tradition, promote marriage among Jews, and to assure the future of American Jewry. Conclusion. If the gentleman's agreement is understood to embrace both of these undertakings, we are left with an ethical dilemma. What should one make of a tacit agreement between anti-Semitic Gentiles who are engaged in invidious discrimination and observant Jews who are pursuing a laudable goal? Perhaps the modern memory chooses to reinvent the past in order to avoid this moral quandary.